From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Oprah Winfrey was doing a show in Chicago, and it was for young. It was for women who did not have a father in their lives. And so my mother happened to see it, and she said, you should write in to Oprah and, you know, see if you can get on the show. But I thought to myself, what are the chances that I would get on? But I still wrote in. And a few days later, I was contacted, and they told me that they wanted me to come and be a part of the show. So my mother and I went on that show, and there were other women from all around the country who had grown up without a father. And they were so, it's like every time that, you know, I spoke to someone during the show or after the show, in between breaks and stuff, there was so much hurt, so much pain, and people were looking at me saying, you know, well, what do we need to do to be healed? Healed was like the number one word that I took from that show, and that so many women were not healed.
Tanette Powell, motivational speaker, author, education consultant, and co-founder of The Truth Heals. Powell has made it her mission to be a voice of hope and healing for some of the world's most despaired and underserved populations. Powell currently serves as the CEO of The Truth Heals and sits on a host of nonprofit boards. She has also authored 3 books, including a 4th-grade history book for Omaha Public Schools. Powell grew up with a father addicted to drugs. While father wasn't looking, she struggled in school with behavioral issues and was labeled at risk, broken, and defeated. After surviving high school and dropping out of college just 2 years in, she set sail in search of herself. 4 years after dropping out of college, Powell gave it another try and found her purpose in a public speaking course at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. After excelling in the class, she declared her major as speech communication and worked to develop herself into a voice for some of the world's most neglected people. Her work to expose America's preschool to prison pipeline has been featured by media outlets throughout the country, including CNN, MSNBC, and NPR's This American Life. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Truth Heals with Tanette Powell, In Black America.
Despite everything my father did, I never heard her say anything bad about him. Despite, you know, our living conditions, she always, always tried to give us the best she could, you know, and I think that those 2 factors, you know, the love of God that she showed me and the way that she lived her life and the way that she did, I think that those were probably the things that got me through. And I can tell you what kept me beyond that was education. It was my passport. As Malcolm X said, you know, education is our passport. And I know people don't believe that a lot. And I didn't believe that. I hated school growing up. But it wasn't until I went back to college, that's when I found myself. That's when I figured out what I could do and that it didn't have to be, you know, what I saw every day. I could really think outside the box. If you asked me as a child, I would have never envisioned this life.
In the summer of 2013, Tulane Holder and Tanette Powell, mother and daughter, formed The Truth Heals after appearing on Oprah's Life class for fatherless daughters. They were invited to the show after Tulane suggested that she write in. While in Chicago, they encountered so many daddyless daughters and sons. After the show, so many people throughout the country reached out for healing. Tulane and Tanette were overwhelmed by the startling number of people who needed help. To help them and the millions of other individuals and families affected by fatherlessness, the two decided to form an organization that will allow a country and a world to come together through hope and eventually healing. As a daughter who struggled to find herself and to overcome devastating odds of growing up without a father, and a mother who struggled to deal with it all, they have made it their mission to work with as many individuals and families as they can. It is the hope and prayer that everyone healing and affected by fatherlessness will reach out for help in their journey from daddy-less to destiny.
I was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas, 210. I'm very proud of that. So not too far away from Austin. But, yeah, I spent most of my life there until my adulthood.
Tell her, what was life like growing up in the Alamo City?
Well, for me, it started out a little rocky. My father was addicted to drugs before I was born. So when I was born, I lived in San Antonio. I lived on the southeast side and the east side of San Antonio, which are some of the more impoverished areas.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother and father were married. So my mother did the best she could. Even though they were married, she was more of a single parent because my father was in and out of prison and abusing drugs, you know, in a very unhealthy way that it really just crushed us. And then right when I started middle school, they got a divorce, and he was in prison most of the time after that. So my mother did what she could for us, but it was definitely difficult. There were some good moments because my mother did everything that she could, given the circumstances, but it was definitely a difficult childhood in the beginning.
I understand. What were some of your better subjects while you were in school?
My best subjects was always English. So I was always really, really, really good at English. And also any type of public speaking classes or classes where I had to give presentations, those were some of my strongest growing up, yep.
How did you come to work for the San Antonio newspaper?
Well, that's actually a pretty neat story. And if there are any young people listening, I challenge young people to do the exact same thing or something similar that I did if you really have a passion for journalism. My father, like I talked about, he spent a lot of time in prison. And while he was in prison, well, actually when he was at the county jail, he would get the San Antonio Express News. They'd get to read it, you know, most of the time if they went to the library, the paper was there. So he would always write to me and tell me about, you know, the opportunity with the newspaper and that I should look into it and that I should email his favorite columnist. Now, his favorite columnist was a gentleman named Kerry Clack. And if you don't know Kerry Clack, he's incredible. He's no longer at the newspaper now. He does communications for a lot of politicians. But so I trusted him. I told my dad, I said, okay, I'm going to write in. And I wrote in to Kerry, and I just told him that my dad was a fan, and, you know, he introduced me to his column, and he was writing about, you know, telling a lot of stories for African Americans in San Antonio. He was telling those good stories, or even if he had to talk about a not so good topic, he found a different perspective. And so he and I started emailing back and forth, and he asked me if I would, you know, write little prompts. He gave me writing prompts, and he said, you know, write something about this and write something about that. And I did, and everything that I wrote to him, he sent it to his editor, and they offered me a job at 19 years old.
And tell us about some of the stories that you wrote about back then.
So some of the stories I wrote about, I was very fortunate because when I got to the newspaper, it was, now we see a lot of cuts and things like that, and it's really been really difficult lately for newspaper. But when I first got there, that was in 2005, it was still, you know, it was kind of just open to who you wanted to be. So I worked in the metro section, which was the city news, and I got to write about, you know, homeless communities. That was probably one of my best times where, you know, really just getting to go and just hang out with the homeless community and you know, look at some of the stigmas that are attached and how, and some of the stereotypes and how they're not always true. I wrote a lot of obituaries about, you know, people from all over the community, and I always tried to find people who wouldn't normally be in the newspaper to showcase maybe it was a lady who cleaned houses all of her life, you know, or, you know, a father who, you know, decided to stay at home and dedicate his life to his kids. They wouldn't normally end up in the paper. I tried to write those type of stories. I tried to write about the hip-hop scene in San Antonio and up-and-coming artists. I wrote about some of the athletes in San Antonio who were trying to go from, you know, poverty to the D-League to the NBA, so stories like that.
What led you to write The Other Woman?
Well, The Other Woman. So, and that has a, you know, that book has a lot of rich San Antonio history in it and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It looks specifically at, you know, what drugs was like during those, you know, that early 80s, late 70s, when crack cocaine hit.
Right.
But I was led to write The Other Woman in 2011. I was already living in Omaha, Nebraska for about 6 months, and I was on the phone with my father. He had been out of prison, and I was on the phone with my oldest brother as well. It was a three-way call, and they were arguing, so they wanted me to be the mediator. My father wanted drug money, and my brother didn't want to give him his money, so he was trying to freeze his bank account. And they were arguing back and forth, and when I hung up off the phone, I just kind of broke down. You know, it became this place where inside of me, where I felt so sad that it didn't matter how much I tried, how far I moved. You know, people always say if I can just get out of the city, it'll be different, where it wasn't different. And so I broke down, and I didn't know what else to do, but going back to my favorite subjects being like English, I knew that I could write, And so I just started writing to kind of vent and as a form of therapy for myself. And the more I wrote, you know, it turned into a book.
Tell us about some of the turmoil that a young woman goes through when one of their parents has an addiction.
Yeah, it is very difficult. And I know that we live in a society where we see this, you know, very frequently. We see, you know, drug addiction plaguing two-thirds of the country, you know, of two-thirds of families in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, it was very difficult. You know, some of the things with it being my father or my father not being there, that meant that my mother was trying to raise three kids. That also meant that she had to work a lot more and that was less time to watch us. So throughout my childhood, you know, I was molested by a family friend. And, you know, that really affected me all throughout my life, including in my early adulthood, because, you know, I didn't want to tell anybody, you know, things like that. There were days where, you know, my father would take everything that we had, pawn our TV, our food out of the refrigerator, sell our toys before Christmas, all of those type of things that were really, really crushing for a kid. And, I didn't grow up really understanding, you know, I knew more about street life and those type of things and prison life than I did about, you know, trying to dream outside of a box and think about doing other things in my life. So it was very difficult. I felt confined to a life that it wasn't, you know, that wasn't my choice.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Jeanette Powell, author, motivational speaker, education consultant, and development specialist. She is also co-founder and CEO of The Truth Heals. You and your mom started Truth Heals. Tell us about that endeavor.
Yes. We started The Truth Heals in 2013, and a really, really interesting happening of events. In 2013 in the summer, Oprah Winfrey was doing a show in Chicago, and it was for women who did not have a father in their lives. And so my mother happened to see it, and she said, "You should write in to Oprah and, you know, see if you can get on the show." But I thought to myself, what are the chances that I would get on? But I still wrote in, and a few days later I was contacted, and they told me that they wanted me to come and be a part of the show. So my mother and I went on that show, and there were other women from all around the country who had grown up without a father. And they were so, it's like every time that, you know, I spoke to someone during the show or after the show, in between breaks and stuff, there was so much hurt, so much pain, and people were looking at me saying, you know, well, what do we need to do to be healed? Healed was like the number one word that I took from that show, and that so many women were not healed. And they had done a segment before that on the men as well, and so many of the men were not healed. So when I got back to my home and I was talking to my mom about the show, you know, we started thinking about what could we do. And my publishing company at the time wanted me to write a book about, you know, that healing process. And my mom and I said, well, we have to do something else too. A book is not enough. You know, we need to be able to help these women and help these young men and help, you know, and all these things. So I started working with people, you know, all across the country strategically, looking at what could we do. And we decided that starting The Truth Heals, you know, a nonprofit that looks specifically at fatherlessness, was the best idea.
Do you all conduct workshops under that banner?
Yes. Yes, we do. So what we do is, and this is my main thing with The Truth Heals, is that I'm sure a lot of people might not know all the statistics attached with growing up without a father, but there are a lot of them. So like 71% of pregnant teens are from fatherless homes. 85% of youth who display behavioral issues at school are from fatherless homes. 71% of high school dropouts from fatherless homes. You know, if you look at, you know, our incarceration rates and who our prison makeup is, the majority are from fatherless homes. So we have a huge problem, but this is the thing, for so long where we've lived in a society where we've treated the symptoms and we didn't get down to the root cause. And so what we really focus on with our six-week workshops is looking at the root cause, which once you target that, it's going to clean up those, you know, those symptoms and heal those symptoms. And our six-week workshops focus on the motto of tell your story, let it go, and create a new story.
Can you put your finger on one particular idea or thought that got you through all this, you were able to overcome those statistics?
Yeah, wow. One, well, I would have to say that it definitely was the foundation that my mother had given me, you know, showed me the relationship with God. That was a huge piece for me because I should have been, you know, I should have been all of those things,
mm-hmm.
if I'm being honest with you, and a lot of grace and mercy because I didn't make the right decisions with guys. I should have been a teen parent. You know, I definitely got in trouble at school all the time, so I was in one of those. But, you know, I did things that I'm not proud of, but I know it was a lot of grace and mercy, and I think that it did help to have a mother like I had. So there are some homes that are not as fortunate, and some young people who don't have, you know, they're struggling with their mother and their father. So that makes it a lot more complex. But my mother was a person who, you know, despite everything my father did, I never heard her say anything bad about him. Despite, you know, our living conditions, she always, always tried to give us the best she could, you know. And I think that those two factors, you know, the love of God that she showed me and the way that she lived her life and the way that she did, I think that those were probably the things that got me through. And I can tell you what kept me beyond that was education. It was my passport. As Malcolm X said, you know, education is our passport. And I know people don't believe that a lot. And I didn't believe that. I hated school growing up. But it wasn't until I went back to college, that's when I found myself. That's when I figured out what I could do and that it didn't have to be, you know, what I saw every day. I could really think outside the box. If you asked me as a child, I would have never envisioned this life.
I understand. I also understand that you're the first female in your family to graduate college?
That is correct, and the second person. So my oldest brother was the first person in our whole family to ever graduate from college, and I became the first woman, and I'm still the only woman right now, but we have, you know, some family members who will be graduating soon, and I hope that'll change. But that was a huge thing for me because I really, really wanted to inspire my younger cousins that they don't have to be, you know, their circumstance, you know. And I wanted to inspire, you know, people all around me that it is difficult, and it took me longer to graduate, you know, than the 4 year, than the typical 4 year. And it motivated my little brother to go back to school. You know, he was at a place where he was, you know, ready to just be done. But he said, you know, if you could do it with two kids, why can't I? And so that's all I ever wanted to be, was just, you know, to live my life in a way that others, you know, wanted to do great things as well.
I was looking on the internet some weeks ago, and I ran across an article in which you had written regarding your sons. Tell us about that experience.
Yes. So last year, this same time, I was going through a lot with I have two sons. I'm actually going to have a third son in about 10 days. So,
congratulations.
But I have thank you. But I have two sons, and they were going to the same school, and they were getting suspended. I mean, in the span of about 2 months, they probably made up about 8 suspensions. And that was very difficult for me because, you know, of course, every parent, you want your child to do the good thing, and we all think great things about our kids. But because I work in a lot of education sectors and I'm around kids all the time and, you know, I'm in these situations, I've always felt like suspensions have been a big problem in our school systems. And so when my kids at, you know, 3 and 4 years old were being sent home, I thought to myself, how can that even be a thing? Where do they suspend 3 and 4 year olds? How can a 3 year old even comprehend a suspension? And so it goes back to, you know, what I do best, you know, my best skill is writing. So I started writing blogs, voicing, you know, what I was going through, and it got picked up by national media. And, you know, and what we found is that it wasn't just my kids. You know, they were the U.S. Department of Education released a study a few months later. You know, I think it was March or April of last year, they released a study that showed that, you know, black boys make up 18% of all preschools across the country, but they make up for 43% of all suspensions in preschool. Well, that's unacceptable, you know, and so it kind of changed my life because as I started off as just a parent who needed to vent and didn't feel like something was right, but actually turned into this, you know, advocate now and started looking at all these complex issues and looking back, you know, at the theory of the preschool to prison pipeline and what we could do about that.
And looking at your essay, I was kind of struck back, and I think you were also, when you were, I guess, talking with other mothers in the family, and one had expressed that her son had done something a little bit more egregious than your two sons, and all they did was call her.
Yes, and that parent has stuck to that. I mean, despite all this national attention, I've spoken to her, and that was true. You know, she had, this parent was white, and she, you know, we were at a birthday party, and I was talking to her about it, and I mean, she was in shock when I told her that my son had been suspended. And she was like, I wonder how do you get suspended? Because, you know, my son, you know, he did this. She started saying all these things that he had done. But she was like, all I got was a phone call. And that's when it really, really hit me that something is not right. Because believe me, you know, most people say, well, you need to discipline your kids. You know, you need to get in your kids. And you better believe that that's always first for me. That, you know, I don't live, you know, in this, oh, my kids can do no wrong. No, I know that my kid, you know, kids can and kids might, you know, and they probably will. And so I took those steps. But then after that, I had to start thinking about it when I'm hearing from other parents who are not black that their kids did similar things or worse things and did not get suspended.
Now, I understand. What has given you the impetus to tell your story and also become a dynamic public speaker?
That has not been easy, and that's one of the things I tell people all the time. It has not been easy. I feel like, I mean, it's my calling. It's in me. It's in me to tell my story, and I feel like it, because when something is, you know, when you're called to do something, or, you know, you feel like this is what your life's work is about and your purpose in life, if you don't do it, it eats at you. And so when I tell my story, it's the only way that I've been able to heal and to help other people heal. And, you know, it's like it's the one thing that takes everything out of me. But when I'm done, it replenishes me. And so, you know, it's been something that I felt like, you know, I have to do it. I don't really have a choice. You know, God has not given me a choice. He has said, you know, I'm going to tell my story and I'm going to use my voice as a speaker. And I never wanted to be a, you know, a motivational speaker or public speaker. And people, you know, now they'll say, oh, that's what I want to be. That was not what I wanted to be. Someone pulled me to the side and said, this is what you're going to be.
And looking at your website, I was kind of set back when you said it takes 28 days to develop a habit.
Yeah, so that theory there, it goes, oh, so I do a lot of stuff with 28 days, and I do a lot of leadership consulting and things like that with 28 days, because when my father, like I said, I go back with everything with my father, which I should mention that now, he and I have a very, very strong and solid relationship. He's been clean now for a few years, and he's doing well. You know, he's in his 50s, and now he's learning, you know, regular day-to-day life lessons. But while he was in rehab, most of his rehab is really, really focusing in on 28 days. So that's how he spoke to me when we talked and when we, you know, when I was going through things and when he tried to encourage me through prison letters, it was always looking at 28 days. And so if you think about that, that's about a month. And when I talk to people about leadership or bettering themselves or anything on that level, if you tell someone to do it the same thing for 28 days, that's not very overwhelming. You know, it's not saying commit to something for 5 years or for 1 year. It's 28 days. But it's been very effective.
And looking at some of the research information for this interview, I saw that you had a speaking engagement with your dad, I think, while you were in San Antonio.
Yes,
how did absolutely. That go off?
It went good. It's always a little awkward at first for me because, you know, they're going to ask my dad the tough questions. And,
right.
You know, of course, when I wrote The Other Woman, you know, detailing his life and, you know, and the drug addiction and all of that stuff, you know, people thought, you know, well, how's your dad going to feel about this? But I think the one thing that people don't know is that if you read that book, there's no way I could have written that book without him. So there were times, you know, when I talk about, you know, the drug life before I was even born, well, those are prison, those are direct interviews with him. And so my dad has been a very avid supporter. Some of his family weren't so happy when The Other Woman first came out, and it was him who pulled me to the side and said, you know, stay focused on why you wrote this book. And he said, you know, as long as I'm good with it, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. And so I felt like my dad knew that, you know, I had to write this book and that, you know, I had to go on this path. And so when we spoke together in San Antonio, he answered every question. My dad's a very honest man. It actually went very well. And I think if people, you know, hear him talk, you'll see a lot of things. You know, yes, you'll see it. You know, you'll be like, man, you know, he missed out on a lot of his kids' lives and he did a lot of things. But you'll also see a man who was really, really wrapped into drug addiction. I think you'll understand the power of drug addiction, and you'll also understand just how detrimental the failed war on drugs has been, especially to the black community. So I think that's what people took away, and I think people liked him more after that, after we spoke together.
I know that's right. Tell us about the Youth Diversity and Leadership Workshops for K through 12.
Yeah, so with those workshops, and they're always a lot of fun, you know, I like to talk to, you know, I think one of the biggest things is leadership. But when we talk about leadership to young people, we always talk about it like it's something that they can't have right now. You know, it's something when we tell them to think about leaders, we always say, you know, President Barack Obama, who obviously is, you know, our nation's leader. But do they ever think about themselves as leaders? And so that's really what, you know, the diversity and leadership workshops look at. And they also look at the different forms of leadership. You know, so it doesn't have to be the typical, you know, you're the president of the United States or you're the class president or, you know, you're the team captain on the sports, you know, team or things like that. So we try to look at every angle of leadership throughout those workshops. You know, we've paired them with local leaders in the community who are young and old, so they can see a lot of different faces, men and women of all different creeds and kinds, because I think that it's important that leadership becomes something that is on their level. Something that they feel I can do it right now. And I think that because when I was younger, I feel like I always had leadership skills. They might have showed up in negative ways because I didn't know how to express them because I didn't have a platform to do that. But, and once I, you know, and it wasn't until I was older that I realized all that time that was leadership, but people made leadership seem like something I couldn't have yet. And so that's the whole idea. It's something that young people can have and that they should want, and it comes with responsibility. It comes with integrity, you know, and all these different things. But that's pretty much what the workshops focus on.
Tonette Powell, motivational speaker, author, education consultant, and co-founder of The Truth Heals. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.